snooze has been canceled. Stay tuned for the Mattel and Mars Bar Quick Energy Chocobot Hour.
You can count on us, Mr. President. Major Nougat, Gooey, Coco, put down those entertaining Mattel products. Colonel Katappi is up to his old tricks.
Let's power up!
Okay, fellas.
Hello, and welcome back to Game Rarer. It's a chocotastic, wondiferous, splendiferous return to form. It's Game Rarer 2. We're back, and we've got a very fun slate of episodes coming up. As always, I'm one of your hosts, Sam. And who's joining me today?
That would be Party Bag, Peanut M&M's David, Delicious Treats from M&M's.
Registered to Mars Incorporated.
Yes.
So, how have you been in, I guess, this month in gaming? I haven't, like, done a full, like, audit on, like, everything that's been going on. To be completely honest, I took a bit of a break away from playing the game super often. I continued doing a little bit of prep for segments ahead of time, but it was nice to be able to pump the brakes a bit. Mm-hmm. What have you been up to lately?
Well, aside from enjoying the absolutely refreshing taste of M&M's,
mm-hmm.
I've been playing. What have I been playing? I played Jackass on the PS2.
Jackass, I was gonna say.
That game. Now the thing about Jackass is that those brave soldiers lay their life on the line mm-hmm. for our entertainment, but the Jackass game kind of stretches credibility a little bit.
Yeah.
In the sense that multiple mini games, because all mini games involve you launching yourself off the rooftop of a city building, like a big skyscraper, yeah. to what is obviously going to be your death.
Yeah.
and also, yeah, there's like ones where it's like you have to go down a ski slope on a fridge, which. You know, physics wise, you know, that's not gonna happen. There's one where
yeah.
you make a big kind of snowball and you like gather up people like a Klonoa. Not Klonoa, what am I talking about? The thing where you collect rubbish, make a big ball. What can I remember?
Oh, Katamari.
Katamari damn, God, that tells you how long away? How far away? How far away? Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
What does matter is M&M's. But yeah, I've been playing that. I played, because I've been trying to. I made a big boo boo, which is that I was like, I'm going to get like all these games onto my special machine.
Uh-huh.
That is definitely legal.
Uh-huh.
And play them all. Not realizing that half of them will be like 4 gigabytes. So I've been playing like games that I. Was like, oh, maybe get to them in like a year. I've been playing them like every single day to clear space.
Yeah.
So
it's not bad. It's not a bad motivation.
It's not, but it is when you end up playing about 10 minutes, not 10 minutes, I play like maybe an hour of Family Guy video game.
Oh, yeah.
And the Brian segments are all stealth. And I'm like, on a good day, I hate stealth sections. I don't like stealth.
Yeah.
I don't like sneaking. I like being open. And the problem was that that game is not designed for stealth, even though the whole thing is about stealth, and I just got really annoyed. So I deleted that file. That was like 3.9 gigabytes, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I played like The Grim Adventures of Billy and Mandy, which is a terrible game. I played that for like 10 minutes, and I was like, this is bad. And it's also like 4 gigabytes. It's gone.
Uh-huh.
Cat in the Hat on PS2, that's fun. It's like a Ooh. 3D platformer. It's kind of... It was all right, but like I just got really kind of bored. It was very repetitive.
The Game Grumps famously played that with Dan Harmon once, of all people. he's just having a meltdown for half of the thing. That's all my familiarity with it. I mean, we've said it before, but it is just like movie tie-ins like that just do not happen anymore.
For good reason.
For very good reason. I mean, they probably a lot of companies went out of business doing that kind of stuff where there just was no return on investment. But yeah, sometimes I miss it, and then, you know, you get something that's like truly dreadful that comes out of nowhere. There was like a there was a tie-in to that Crypto the Superdog superhero pets movie or whatever it was a couple years ago, but it was essentially like they'd retrofitted like Temple Run, but you were just playing it on a console, so it just made absolutely no sense. And they proudly put it on Game Pass for some reason. Lord knows why.
But anyway, other than that, yeah, just kind of, you know, enjoying the work of M&M's. And their sweet, refreshing, beautiful taste.
Yes. We'll get into M&M talk when we get to your segment. On my end, it's mostly just been, I've been doing a lot of reading. I've been doing a lot of sitting around. I found some new favorites. Some new tomes, yeah. And that's been quite fun. I've been in a general sort of like Atari mood again. Every few months I get like kind of fascinated by going back to that story, because I think what sparked it this time was the sort of somewhat recent news. It's going to be like over a month ago by the time the episode comes out, but the news that Atari were reviving the Infogrames brand, or Infogrames. I never know which one it is.
Infogrames.
It's entertainment.
Yeah, I've seen that song.
Oh god. But that, I think, stokes the fire in my head again, and I've just been doing some reading up on the Atari ST and the Amiga and the sort of like weird rivalry that was going on there, because it's like, you know, that's way before my time, but I always find earlier PC stuff really interesting. So lots of reading up about that. A lot of also figuring out which sources are like historically relevant, and then which ones I get about like 20 pages into and I'm like, oh, this is just a technical manual. This is just like someone telling you in like 1997 how to program for the thing. This probably isn't going to help. And then outside of that, been on a small racing game kick. I picked up Burnout Paradise on the Switch, which I'd played before on Xbox, but the Switch version went down to like a fiver relatively recently, and I was like, you know what, it might play a little better in handheld than on console. It's from sort of the early to midpoint of the seventh gen, so it's one of those games that's got that kind of Vaseline filter. Even in the remaster, it just doesn't look quite right. It's a bit overly grimy. And I didn't quite like that when it was blown up on a TV screen, but on a handheld it's actually not too bad. It's a good game to just jump in, do a couple events, jump back out. I do definitely prefer Burnout with like a big menu where you just select circuits and then you just do it that way. Burnout Paradise, it's all driving around the map, going to specific locations and then starting the events from there. And that can be a bit annoying, because sometimes you might be like, well, I want to do a road rage event, which is just the event where you're just constantly smashing people off the road. There's no actual race element. It's just pure like stress relief, but you have to drive all the way to the other end of the map to get it. And then, you know, you're going to get distracted by everything on the way. That's the way these open world maps work. It's like, oh, there's a sign I can smash. There's a jump I can do. There's, and you know, that's meant to be part of the loop, but sometimes I just, dang it, I just want to boot up Burnout and I just want to do road rage. There's no crash mode as well, which is a bit of a travesty. I don't know if you have much experience with Burnout, David. It's a fantastic series.
Just my personal life. not
you're familiar with the concept of the abstract concept of Burnout.
Well, I did buy Burnout. Was it Burnout Paradise? I got for like $1.99 on PS5. Well, PS4, because I was like, I'll get this because it's cheap.
Yeah,
but I haven't played it at all. So
that's the most recent one. It's the only one that's available currently. I mean, it's the most, I say it's the most recent one. It came out in 2008. And then it got a remaster 10 years later, and that's still the most recent thing they've done.
The remaster is what they've got.
Yeah, that's right. So it's good that there's a Burnout available. I do want to pick up Dangerous Driving, which is the sort of spiritual successor that some of the guys from Criterion split off. Made a new studio, and then they started making sort of Burnout style games. They're doing some kind of sequel under THQ Nordic, which has got me a bit like, it's called like Recreation, and it's like, so it seems like it's going to be a big crossover between the Burnout mechanics and Trackmania, where you can build tracks, but then there's also all the like wrecking and stuff going on. but it keeps getting like quietly delayed, and they haven't talked about it in a while, and I'm getting a little antsy. I'm like, ooh. It's one of those ones where you check the Amazon page and it just says the release date is like the 31st of December this year, and you're like, so I hope that turns out all right. I do always get worried about games that build themselves around, I think I've talked about it before, but you know, when games build themselves around games as a service or like online sharing or you know, level building, user generated content, that can be tricky, because I think some games just don't really, it takes a lot to build like a community that's going to be really into it. Like, not everyone can be Mario Maker or Little Big Planet. So those games kind of live or die off the user generated stuff. And if people don't get in early and make a lot of good stuff, then it tails off very quickly. But yeah, that's what I've been playing mostly, just hopping in and out of Burnout, and then some general Atari noodling.
Consulting the ancient texts and
yes.
Yeah.
Ripping it up.
So as I said, my name this week is Party Bag Peanut M&M's Day with Delicious Treats from M&M. Yes, this week I will talk about the glorious video game of the 2000s. That's right, M&M's Shell Shock. As on the PlayStation 1. Not owned by M&M's, but I think we all agree. There's still time. The M&M brand, of course, is important. Because it's such a vital part of how this game works. Without it, you know, just be Shell Shock, and that's a song from the recent Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie. Recent in 2010s, I don't know. What I do know is that it's a slippery slope when it comes to not liking M&Ms. Not liking them leads to many things, including crime, war, and not having delectable sweet treats. You'd be hard pressed to find someone who, faced with the choice of, you know, delicious M&Ms and a big gun that shoots things, would choose the gun, unless the gun had added a delicious and crisp sugar coating, or fired a yummy little chocolate treats, you know? So why did the public not go goo goo gaga for some great M&M video games? The appetite was there for gaming, you know? Look at Nintendo and other companies, they were making consoles, so why did people not want to play a little fun game on this old gaming console? Sam, I can't pretend anymore, okay? I don't want to disappoint you or any of our literal fans. There's like five of them. But the truth is, the only thing is, I couldn't get an M&M. I couldn't get the M&M brand to sponsor us. I tried super hard. I can show it to you. I need you to read this out, because I sent an email to their official customer service that I want you to read out.
Okay.
I'm gonna send you the screenshot, because it was one of those like contact windows, and I didn't get a receipt in my email. So I've sent you the email that I'd like you to read out. Don't read out my email address, but you can read out the message.
I see your address here. I see your national insurance number. Yeah, let's dig in.
Yeah. Okay. That will help.
Okay. To whom it may concern, I'm a podcaster and podcast professional, producer, editor, artist, presenter, the whole bucket, and then some. And I was hoping you'd be able to help me out. This is for a podcast called Gamer Era. I will be covering M&M-related video games, such as M&M's Shell Shock and M&M's Adventures. Boy, what an experience. And I would love it if you could sponsor me for the episode. I could promote your delicious brand of chocolate treat for gamers everywhere. Please let me know if you'd be interested. I'm sure we have some listeners who have never even heard of chocolate before. Regards, David.
Yeah, so I sent that.
There's a little disclaimer underneath that says there is a 1,000 character limit for your message, which yeah. I think is just a boilerplate thing, but it sounds like they're like, all right, hurry it up, but you know, sycophant.
Well, I thought it would work, and the thing is, they just kind of ignored me, which is quite rude, because they said it'd be like 48 hours to get back to me.
I don't think that's in the interests of the Mars Corporation to ignore people like that.
No, I know the dedicated fans of this, you know?
Yeah.
I thought I'd fight to get noticed by them by covering their games, even though I got the name of one of them wrong in my email. I realized afterwards it's M&M Adventure, not M&M Adventures. But hey, Popley's an effect, you know? Please ignore the fact that I told him I was going to do that before I decided to do that as well. I just call being prepared, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, Sam. What's the one word you associate with M&Ms?
Crisp.
That's right, crunchy. A millimeter of crunch in there. That's actually true. So what's more video games than crunch? Anyway, we can start at the beginning, you know? I'm not talking about when the M&M was invented in the early 40s as a result of this guy seeing Smarties for the first time. And being like, holy cow, what's that?
Yeah.
I'm talking about the year 2000. Crunch. The year 2000 is not what Busted sang about, of course, but it's when two games were released. M&M's The Lost Formulas on the PC.
Oh.
And M&M's Mini Madness on the Game Boy Color.
Okay.
This is when I know that the minis play into the plot of both of these games. What also mean I have not played The Lost Formulas owing to them being lost.
Yes.
Yes. Also because it's a PC game and I can't emulate PC at the moment.
Yeah.
Also because Shell Shock is actually a remake of The Lost Formulas, but it replaces all the educational content and replaces it in the Shell Shock with boss battles.
Oh.
Because the M&M company hates people learning, you know?
Yeah. Crunch. Incidentally, my sister had a M&M's solar-powered calculator, and it was an absolute piece of crap.
Yeah, because they're not interested in you learning, you know? Crunch.
Absolutely not.
Mm-hmm.
Half the display was completely broken. It was just like, oh, yeah, what's the answer to this number? 8-8-8-8-7-6-8-8-8. Oh, okay, cool. Yeah. Good to know.
Yeah. The minis were introduced in 1996. 4 years later, they were in video games. That's like when the president gets elected in America, you know? Donald Trump, though.
Yeah.
Donald Trump is not an M&M. That's an awfully hot coffee pot. Crunch. So anyway, M&M's Mini Madness on the Game Boy Color. It's a side-scrolling platformer. You have to swap between M&M's. There's the red one, the yellow one, the green one, and the blue one. They all have different abilities. I don't know what they are, really. Yellow can jump high, I think. I know that one because I played this for like 30 minutes.
Right.
You go on a skateboard.
Obviously, the green one can seduce people, right?
Yeah. Oh my God. Well, not anymore because of woke.
Because they changed the shoes.
Because of woke. No, that's a joke. You go on a skateboard. That's fun. I can't skateboard. I tried once, and poor balance, and also they ain't M&Ms. It isn't M&Ms, I mean. Except for this instance, you have to hit levers. I skipped all the cutscenes. They're drawn by a computer, so, yeah.
You're anti-AI art.
Yeah.
You're very confused. Yeah. You're like, I will never watch Toy Story. Computers made that.
I can't look at drawings because the computer might have made that. Yeah. The game on the Game Boy Color, it was made by Pipe Dream Interactive, Inc., which stands for Incorporated. Just like how Crunch is incorporated into M&M's. They also made M&M's Blast for the GBA, which I couldn't find. But I believe it involves golf, which is something Chocolate has never played before. If you think about it, I'll discuss who published it later on because I think I need to do more research into that right now. Because it is fucking impossible to beat the SEO trap on the company in question. I wrote that in late April. So I did do the research, don't worry. The Lost Formulas, it's on the PC. Which is definitely what the M&Ms are because we all saw what happened. You know, we all saw what freaking happened to the freaking green M&M. Am I right, Sam? Am I right,
yep.
Sam? Am I right? Because what happened to the green M&M? You know, remember when that happened, Sam? The green M&M. Remember, Sam? Remember? Remember that what happened?
Very much.
The Lost Formulas. It's the same game as the one I'm going to talk about. Only it's on the PC, so it looks crisp and not crunchy. The only difference, as I said, otherwise, is that it has maths. Mathematics are in this game. Mm. Numbers. You just jump on platforms where voiceover tells you a sum. It's like freaking maths. You know, it literally is maths. I wrote this bit at 28 minutes past midnight on April 30th. I made a note of that when I was doing my notes. Quiz time.
Okay.
M&M's trivia.
This is so rapid fire. We covered like 3 games in about 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm. 10 fascinating facts about M&Ms from the website Listverse. Are you familiar with this article? Don't look it up at home. This is written by Mark Lee and, as the website notes, fact checked by Jamie Fraser.
Okay.
The blue M&Ms were introduced to replace the tan M&Ms in 1995. The decision was left to the public's vote, and the results were 54% in favour of the colour blue.
I love whenever votes like that are always so like weirdly close.
The choice was between purple, blue, and pink as the new colour. Over 10 million people voted in the competition over the course of two allotted months.
What?
When blue was chosen, the Empire State Building was lit up blue to celebrate. The New York skyscraper is often lit up with different colors to celebrate certain holidays. The building is red on Valentine's Day and yellow and white to celebrate Easter. M&Ms have frequently been associated with American patriotism, so it seems only appropriate to see the product associated with a landmark in one of the country's greatest cities. M&Ms trivia. Okay, 1996. What else happened then? I'll tell you. You tell me. Yes, that's right. I will. Crash Bandicoot. Uh-huh. He ran out into our screens, and we did stop before we hit him. Thank you very much. Crunch. You know who saw that happen? The M&Ms. That's right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Lost 4 months in Sheltered are very heavily indebted to that game. Anyway. Stop! Think. Think back to the past. Okay, remember when I said this? And I'll quote myself directly here. I'll discuss who published it later, because I think I need to do more research into that right now, mostly because it is fucking impossible to beat the SEO trap on the company in question. Well, now is the time.
Okay.
This game was published by what? Huh? Simon & Schuster, the book company? Say it ain't so, but it is. They launched their interactive division in 1995. After previous attempts at gaming with Simon & Schuster software. That, mm-hmm. as far as I know, lasted 8 games. Including The Great Gonzo in Word Rider, and then like 5 Star Trek games.
Is among those as well, I'm pretty sure. Mm-hmm.
But after that, and as Interactive, they appear to go, huh, let's go and publish a few more Star Trek games. And then stuff like Richard Scarry's Busy Town, yes. Best Math Program Ever, Panty Raider From Here to Immaturity, Cheerios Playtime, Forbes Corporate Warrior, and of course, M&M's The Lost Formulas.
Forbes Corporate Warrior?
Yeah.
Wow, that's a lead.
Yeah, we're all corporate warriors here. Mini Madness Blast, I think Shell Shock has a remake, I don't know, Crunch. M&M's Trivia. Again, from the same article by that guy. E.T. wasn't the only example of Mars turning down an opportunity for M&M's to be part of the entertainment industry. A season 4 episode of Seinfeld showed Jerry and Kramer observing a heart operation. Kramer is eating a pack of Junior Mints when he accidentally knocks one of them from the observation desk and into the open chest cavity of the patient. They remain silent as the operation ends and the patient is closed up with the mint inside.
Christ.
This scene gave Junior Mints a lot of publicity. In fact, the episode even ends in one of the Stancia commercial. When offered a Junior Mint by Kramer, the doctor states that they can be very refreshing. Declining the opportunity for their product to be used in this episode of Seinfeld is yet another example of Mars failing to trust others with their M&M's brand. What are you eating? Jerry Seinfeld asked in the episode. Kramer replied, Junior Mints, you want one? That could have been you, M&M's. Funnily enough, over the credits, there was a stand-up scene with Jerry where he riffs on the idea of the colors of M&M's being completely different when you were younger. It appears as though Seinfeld ultimately won. M&M's trivia.
I think they wouldn't have got on given some of the statements Seinfeld himself has said lately. Because of woke.
Because of woke. M&M's take a few years off of the video games now, okay?
Okay, they don't want to burn themselves out.
No. 2007, George Bush is president. You forgot Poland. M&M's, they put out a hit on the video game industry by releasing a game on the Nintendo DS and the Game Boy Advance called M&M's Break 'em. Who is they? The freaking industry, that's who. Eating M&M's on the go. Frame Studios developed it. It's a clone of their game Gem Smashers, I think, because the Wikipedia page cites a review from IGN that just says, not as good as Gem Smashers, or whatever. Okay, I just read the rest. This is also a note for me from the past saying, okay, I just read the rest of the Wikipedia page. But I said that on May 1st, 2024, not right now, insert date here. This is, I think, a passage I copied and pasted from Wikipedia. I didn't leave any note to say if it was or not. It reads like one. This is a game where you can play as five different colored M&Ms and try to stop Mr. Runch, a rotten and dangerous peanut, fiercely determined on being one of the M&Ms.
What?
He escaped the reject bin where he was discarded, and he's on the loose in the galaxy, where he is trying to kidnap and trap all of the M&Ms into crystals until he can get what he wants. The chance to become a real M&Ms candy. This game is a remake of Gem Smashers made by the same company. That's what it says. I can't argue. It's not a very good game, but it's competent compared to what's to come.
Yeah.
It was published by Destination Software, who will return soon. Break them. More like friggin' break me. A year later, in fact, Obama is president. Yes, we can talk about M&Ms, that is. 2008 sees two more M&M games, you know. They're two of the worst games I've ever played. Let's be honest here. Let's talk about cars first. Crunch! That's the sound of a car hitting something. In this case, it's hitting a copy of M&M's Kart Racing. On the Wii and DS. I played on the DS. Developed by Frontline Studios, Inc. That's how it's stylized. It's stylized with full caps, Frontline, and the rest of the Studios, Inc.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Destination Software were involved, I believe. Anyway, it maps the camera to the directional buttons. So when you go around the corner, the camera goes with you, so you crash into walls a lot. At least I did anyway. I was crashing here and there and everywhere. I did this race. I haven't really talked about Shellshocked. Shellshocked is just like you're going through the factory to fight Beckett's minis. You're doing like platforming. You play as a yellow M&M. He says oopsie doopsie or something all the time. It's really annoying. Yeah. It's not as annoying as M&M's Kart Racing, because it came at a time where everyone was kind of throwing shit at the DS to see what worked, you know. Mobile kart racing, yes please, you know, and so on, if you will. The game does not cook like other games do in certain ways, you know. The power-ups you get just don't really feel like anything special. The courses feel so devoid of personality. It reminds me a lot, actually, of I don't know if you ever played Cartoon Network Racing on the DS.
No,
absolutely abysmal. It's one of the worst games I've ever played. It's like, it's a terrible kart racer. Famously has like 144p copies of like three different Cartoon Network cartoons on. I think one of them's
brilliant.
It's like one episode of Dexter, is one episode I think of Cat Dog maybe, and I think one episode of Courage Carry Dog. I don't know. There's like three of them anyway, and they're like, they sound terrible as well. but that game is like you're driving around a big block of data that has like no real physics other than it's like really slow and you're crashing and you're just kind of, you know, doing whatever. I don't necessarily blame it for anything, because being a licensed kart racing game for the DS in 2008 sounds like an insanely horrible life to live. But it just doesn't feel like an enjoyable experience whatsoever.
Yeah.
Speaking of, what do the following games have in common? Super Mario 64.
Mm-hmm.
Rayman 2, The Great Escape.
Mm-hmm.
M&M's Adventure.
They're all 3D platformers.
That's right, they're all games.
They sure are.
Yeah, they're all they're also 3D platformers, and also playable on Nintendo handhelds in some form. M&M's Adventure is also, and I say this with the greatest of respect, okay? That game is what would happen if they did a Stormbreaker on DS consoles, but instead of a virus they were injecting, it was diarrhea. This is maybe one of the worst games I've ever played, and it's quite something to tell you that, because it is after all based on the M&Ms, you know? Delicious, refreshing treats, nice candy, you know? The basic premise of the game is that the factory gets fucked up and you have to fix it. But that essentially involves you playing through each world like two or three times and to unlock enough green M&Ms, not the green M&M, to open up other worlds, like Super Mario 64 Star System, you know?
Yeah.
Only you swap between red M&M, who's normal, yellow M&M, who can double jump, and then green, who, as far as I know, I didn't unlock green M&M, as far as I know, she is the only M&M that can actually attack enemies. Based on playing through the first level like four times and not be able to hit or attack or destroy any enemies at all, which is really annoying. Mm-hmm. The game belongs to my favorite subgenre, which is when you hit the wall, you see it all. You know what I mean? You don't. I was convinced that given time, I could clip through the environment, basically, but I didn't.
Oh, okay.
I didn't, but there were times where I jumped and I could see like the entire level through the ceiling, and I was like, I'm not meant to be able to see this, but you haven't designed this very well. My favorite bit of the game is when I beat the first boss, who is Cupid. You do the theme in a really specific way, which is that you have to, like, he flies around the room. And I didn't know, now, I have never played a DS game that has fog, but this game is literally like, it's like Silent Hill. You're like walking around. There's so much like render fog because they're like, you know, which I think is because, and I can't verify this, but I saw some footage of the Wii version of this game. And you know, like when you get like a DS version of like a Wii game, or a game that's also on Wii or whatever, and like it's a different experience, you know, it's like a different kind of, it would be like a different dev team or whatever, they'll make like a, you know, like a more of like a different kind of experience, you know. I am 90% sure the DS game is basically a shrunk down version of the Wii game because they look exactly the same, which maybe explains why the game cannot run very well, because I'm pretty sure it is literally just like them being like, just drag this over, strip away everything you can strip away that will make it work.
Yeah.
You know, it looks horrible.
It does look, you sent some footage of it. It's bad.
It sounds horrible too, but the thing is, this Cupid boss battle, Cupid flies around the room. You have to get him to fly into like giant plugs or giant batteries or something. He gets like frozen by like the shock. You jump up platforms, you jump on a button, and for some reason that like injures him. It's the thing is, like with Red, you have to like wait till he's like near the plug and then jump up. With Yellow, because Yellow can double jump, you essentially just have to wait until he's near the platform and you can double jump and hit the button, like the button straight away, and just takes him out. I didn't go back for Green, you know, not since they went, you know, whatever way they went back with the Green M&M. But yeah, Nikitova LLC, who once worked on Splosion Man and Miss Splosion Man, by which I mean after this game, developed this game. Yeah, and much like M&M Kart, whatever, M&M Kart Racing, yeah. They were both published by Zoo Games, who also published M&M's Beach Party on the Wii, which I didn't play because I was kind of checked out, and Calvin Tucker's Redneck Jamboree, which, talk about, you know, excitement. But M&M's trivia.
Okay.
There's no real interest in trivia. I checked, all the rest of trivia is like, M&M's lovely sweet treat. Here's some trivia from me. M&M's has some terrible games. The real Slim Shady is like just the shit you'd play here. I don't know. But they chase trends to stay relevant. You know, they're making like Crash Bandicoot clones. They're making, you know, kart racers. Making like they got a company to remake their own kind of like, you know, maybe successful. I don't know. I've never heard of Gem Smashers, but they got a company to remake their game with the M&M branding. They make like a Super Mario 64 ripoff, clone, whatever, and then insist it goes onto the DS as well. They make all these kind of things to chase trends and stay relevant, but they want the resources to match their ambition. And I mean, really, like, their brownie M&Ms from recently, I don't know if you had them, but they're terrible. They're so dense. They're way too hard. What a joke, you know? And if you'd sponsored me, Mars Corporation, I would have made you an empire. But now? Not a chance. Goodbye, M&Ms. And rotten hell.
Look. If you had one shot or one opportunity to seize everything you ever wanted in one moment, capture, just let it slip. Yo.
So I'm going to start from a place where it's going to sound profoundly unrelated to anything that was just said. It's going to seem like this episode has absolutely no theme whatsoever. But stick with me. We're going to go on a journey. We're going to go through multiple journeys. Multiple tunnels of love, I suppose.
My white ass is sitting down and listening.
And you're listening. So, it's no secret that WarioWare is my favorite game series. Wario is kind of my favorite character alongside of that as well. This is like, obviously WarioWare is gigantic. It's like every single game has like 200 little mini games in it. There's so much you can say about each one. There's all these characters. It's got this wonderful art style. I mean, I don't know what your experience is with WarioWare, David.
I love WarioWare.
A lot of people do. I think it's rare to find people that don't. It's all about chasing the high score, which is very rare in games these days. I always, whenever they announce a new one, I always love going back through the old ones and I just sort of marathon through them because you can finish their like story mode in like an hour. It's, you know, great for an afternoon. The thing I always love about it in particular is they're always introducing new characters and like ancillary members of the cast. And then whoever they introduce sort of like sticks along for the ride. So it's a bit of like an ensemble thing. So, you know, they start out with like sort of some basic archetypes. You've got Jimmy T, who's like the disco guy. And then Mona, who's like the high schooler that's always running between different jobs. Dr. Krygor, the mad scientist. Cat and Anna, the ninja toddlers, like it goes on. Obviously, the big ones that everyone loves are 9-volt and 18-volt, who are like the Nintendo nerds. So their mini games and micro games are all about recreating old Nintendo games. I've written some fanfic in my time as well, which won't get brought up here. It's not saucy or anything. It's just very old and very pedestrian.
Yeah,
but there was a point where I really wanted to make like a WarioWare webcomic work because I love the characters and I'd love to see them explored in more detail. But there's one consistent character who's been there from the very beginning, but is sort of, he's always occupied this sort of outside space from the rest of the cast because he's kind of their fiction within fiction. He's their like Krusty the Clown. And that character is Pyoro, the little red bird. So Pyoro is a especially fun character inside of WarioWare because he's, again, as I said, sort of the fiction within the fiction. He kind of kickstarts the whole series. Like Wario is just sitting on the sofa and then he sees an ad come up for the new Pyoro game. And it's all like, oh, hey, whoa, it sells like hotcakes. It's crazy. And then he gets the idea from that. He gets dollar signs in his eyes and he's like, oh, I'll make money out of games and I'll just get all my friends to make tiny games and then smash it all together. And that'll be a full experience. One of the fun things about WarioWare is that when you finish the main story and you get like a high score in all the games, you actually unlock Pyoro and you get to play it as like a little mini game. And it's this quite fun, it's got like a bit of a Game & Watch style to it, right? It's about like catching beans that fall from the sky, and the higher up in the sky that you catch them, the more points you get. It's like simple, and it's got that sort of like juggling principle to it, you know, where it's like, it's endless. It's, you know, it doesn't, you don't go up a level or anything. It just gets faster and faster. The background changes, the music changes a bit, but you know, it's a high score chaser at the end of it. There's no like campaign or story or anything to it. It's a pure arcade game. It's also been called like Bird and Beans. It was on like the DSiWare store as well. There's a really good clone of it on Playdate, which I don't think I got to mention in the Playdate episode. Like the developer originally made just a direct port of the DSiWare version of Bird and Beans. And then I think Nintendo claimed it or something. So they sort of reskinned it. They turned it into a game called Fish and Feathers. And now the twist is instead of having an extended tongue where you're catching beans falling from the sky, now it's raining fish and you've got to use a fishing rod. And you know what that means, David?
What?
You got to use the crank. So you crank. I mean, The long-running in-joke in the Playdate community is that obviously everyone saw The Crank and everyone was like, oh, make a fishing game.
Mm.
But also the funny thing was everyone thought everyone else was going to make a fishing game first, so nobody made it, you know? Like everyone was fishing games at the same time, and it genuinely, for the first year of the system, we didn't actually have like a traditional fishing game. We eventually got something called Realistic Fishing, which won a ton of awards at last year's Community Awards. Great game. Fish and Feathers gets close because it has this sort of reel-based catching system. It also has a secondary mode where you're piloting a tank. You're going about with the tank and you can control the direction of your shot with the crank independently. So, you know, you've got that sort of analog movement while you're moving about digitally. It's very fun. It's a very clever twist on that formula. So if you have a play date or you know anyone with a play date, Fish and Feathers, very highly recommended. But Pyoro is like one of those things that, again, like with Owari, where he becomes like the constant and he's almost like a sort of unofficial mascot on the side. Like he's their sort of stand-in. I sort of compared him to Krusty the Clown, but really he's sort of like their Mario, right? Mm-hmm. It's a weird universe because Nintendo still exists in that world because like 9-volt and 18-volt are super into it, but then like Wario is a real person, which makes it strange when, you know, like Wario Land mini games come up and stuff. You're like, sure, this is fiction and how much of it isn't. I had this pet theory for a while. I was like, oh, maybe the Wario Land games are Wario like just developing like self-aggrandizing like propaganda. He's like, oh yeah, I'm the coolest guy ever, I'm this cool treasure hunter, and he's like the slob that just sits around. Or alternatively, you know, he founded WarioWare with all the treasure that he got from Wario Land. It's like you can read it whatever way you want. But Pyoro sticks around for all the games and they always sort of change it up, usually around like sort of the gimmick with the game. It's like in WarioWare Touch you're like pulling on his tail and hitting it that way. In Twisted and Smooth Moves and Move It, it's all like gyro based. Even WarioWare Gold goes for like a dual screen idea where I believe you're eating the seeds on the lower screen, but then you can also, oh no, you're eating them on the top screen and the bottom screen has like a view of a garden and you can let some of the seeds fall down through the holes that they create. And then they can plant a beanstalk. And then if you eat the sprout that comes off the beanstalk, you get more points. And if you let like the special beans go down, it's crazy how much depth they add to this really simple like arcade game. But yeah, it's really fun. And it's something that the devs said they always wanted to do on the DS, but they never have the opportunity to. And then obviously in WarioWare Gold, that's like their last chance to use it. So they're like, oh, okay, yeah, let's do it. Pyoro sort of most notably crosses the line between being this fictional game character and becoming real in Get It Together, which has this kind of, that's the like first one on Switch where it's like the twist is that it's like the WarioWare characters all get sucked inside the game. Wario's coding the new game and he just like rushes it along so much that it becomes buggy. And the bug is that it sucks everyone into the game and they have to like play the micro games that way. It's a very fun game. It goes on sale quite cheap very often. I highly recommend it. But sort of when you get to the end of that campaign, you meet Pyoro face to face and you do a little boss battle with him and then you unlock him and he plays the same way he does in the Pyoro games, but now you're like doing micro games with him. It's all very cute. It's all very fun. I think, if I remember right, at least a couple of the characters kind of fanboy out over him because it's sort of, I mean, you know, it's like that, there's that famous Archie Sonic comic called Sonic Live, where you might have seen it, but the cover's this kid on the front and Sonic's reaching out the TV and like grabbing them by the shoulder in this very sinister way. You know, it's like that, the meeting the hero. Mm-hmm. And then now he's just sort of like a real, he's become a real boy. He's real in the WarioWare universe now, as far as I know. They also give him a voice for the first time, and this is where they sort of make him the most Yoshi-like, because he sticks out his tongue and stuff. It's the sound designer of the game just sort of going like, Pyoro! And, you know, they pitch it up in the same way that they did for Tataka when he was doing Yoshi's voice. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a fun sort of callback to that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So you might be like, Sam, okay, you know, this is all very fun, but you're sort of breezing through this whole history of this random bird character. Like, yeah, the Puro games are fun, but like, is that enough to sustain a whole segment? I don't know. Well, dear listener, I have a conspiracy to unravel here. And it's a case that's been wide out in the open. It's actually genuinely been something I've wanted to investigate for a while. And like, this is what I love about this show, is that like, I get full rein to do that. Puro isn't just, he wasn't born in a vacuum. Nintendo didn't even invent him. Puro is nothing but an imitation. He's a parody of a pre-existing character.
No.
And his name is Kyoto-chan.
No! No, you're lying. Please tell me you're lying.
It's all true. No. And the sickening, the truly sickening part, the part that turns your stomach, the part that makes you queasy, is that Kyoto-chan is the mascot for the Japanese equivalent of M&M.
No! No, 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 no.
That's right. No. You're back in the game, baby. No. The crunch never stopped.
No. Crunch, no.
Anyway, would you like to hear about some of the history of Kyoto-chan?
Of course.
Yes. Let's go. So it's a cool, you know, I dramatize to call this the Japanese equivalent of M&M's is they're completely, they're made by completely separate companies. They are functionally the same thing. They're a candy called Choco Ball, which, you know, you see what M&M's are like. These are just sort of rounder, you know, it's chocolate with a crisp, I don't even know what it is, candy shell. And I did consider, you know, committing to the bit, getting some in. And then I was looking at the import sites and it's like, am I really going to spend £7 on a very small box of, you know, M&Ms? Like, I literally have these at home. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and yeah, not worth it. I did make a significantly larger investment, which I disclose. But we'll save that because that's juicy. But yes, so Kyoto-chan is the mascot for Choco Ball, which, as I say, essentially a kind of equivalent to M&M's if you've got to compare it to anything. The character himself, I realized I didn't really give much of a description of Puro. I suppose you could have probably looked him up while I was talking about him. He's this little round red bird with this little yellow beak, and he always looks a little smug, you know? People will also be familiar with Puro, I realize, from the famous leaker who goes about on Twitter. I don't know if you've seen this, David. He posts quite cryptically. He's probably one of the more entertaining leakers. I have some friends that, for very understandable reasons, don't particularly stand for that kind of thing. But he does at least get people guessing, you know? There was, famously last month, he posted a picture of the Nintendo World Championship cartridge with no other context. And people took it as a teaser for Switch 2 because there were two dip switches on it. And then he literally had to clarify afterwards, no, it's because they're going to announce a Nintendo World Championship game on Switch, guys. Very funny. But yeah, Puro, as I'm sure a lot of us are familiar, this very smug looking little bird character, but quite adorable. Kyoto-chan, by comparison, he's still red, but he's sort of got this half like peanut appearance, so he's quite cool and more overly, but he looks just as sort of mischievous. He's always sort of looking off to the side. He has that kind of appearance. I don't know if you've ever sort of watched the pigeons walking about or the birds, and the way that their wings are tucked in, it kind of looks like they've got their hands behind their back. They're just sort of, you know, inspecting, surveying the land. Kyoto-chan has that look at pretty much all times, to the point where they only really draw him with wings or arms, like when they absolutely need to. One of the things I realized while I was looking at all this art and typing this stuff up was he kind of looks like that Kevin James picture where he's like leaning against the counter with his hands in his pockets and he's got that little smile. He's a very, you know, classically appealing character in that way. He's just a little guy. The Kuro-chan name comes from the onomatopoeia Kuro Kuro, which is just for sort of looking around restlessly or like shifty eyes, which is great. And then Chan is obviously just the sort of suffix for, you know, it's a term of endearment. You use it when you're talking about little kids or like a good friend. Sometimes they just call him Kyoro, but I like Kyoro-chan, and it's also a little bit more distinct from Pyoro, which, you know, we'll get back to that. We'll get back to Nintendo's crime. Originally, Chocoball came out in 1965, and it was a tie-in for the anime series Space Boy Solan, which was a Tezuka series, an Osamu Tezuka series. So, you know, like father of anime, basically, Astro Boy, Kimba the White Lion, you know, all the big stuff. Mm-hmm. And the original mascot of the candy was a like sort of alien squirrel called Chappie.
That's Chappie.
That's Chappie. I elbow my wife in the ribs. That's Chappie. Interestingly, as with a lot of Tezuka work, Space Boy Solon and Chappie in particular was embroiled in sort of a plagiarism scandal. I've completely misappropriated it. I don't think Space Boy Solon itself was made by Tezuka, but Tezuka alleged that Chappie stole a character design he had. So it was like, it was something that he didn't actually put out in the world, but, you know, it was something he had in the works. It's kind of like, I don't know if you heard about when the Ice Age guys got sued by someone who alleged that they ripped Scratch. Off Scrat. Yeah, yeah, same sort of thing where it was like, oh, I was going to do something with them and then you didn't. I mean, I'm probably not informed to comment on that. That the person that filed that lawsuit, you know, I'm going to root for them over the corporation any day. I just always thought it was funny that it was like, huh? Okay, sure. Now, interestingly, like the company that makes Chocoball, Morinaga, have a really nice timeline on their site. They go through like through the decades. They have, you know, quite a lot of pride. It's a lot like the sort of M&M's propaganda you were reading off earlier, but you know, it's at the very least it's brief. I don't think they make any sort of allusions to Kuro-chan being a grand patriot or lifting the nation's spirits during any particular events. One of my favorite parts was looking at the 60s, which are described as a decade of both the hippie boom and the bowling alley boom. So like era of the Big Lebowski, kind of, you know, the dude abides.
Mm-hmm.
Very good to hear. There's also like Kuro-chan was like sort of, they started putting him on after they had to take Chappie off. And very quickly he sort of became, you know, endearing as a character in it. His own right. We all sort of know from the outside Japan really enjoys their mascot sort of culture. They have mascots for all kinds of things. Different cities and prefectures have their own mascots. And Kuro-chan is just, again, one of those classically appealing designs that people really gravitated to. So I found a few different bits of like merchandise that were kind of fun. There's like music boxes. There's one where there's like a Kuro-chan that's like conducting a bunch of other like Kuro-chans and like different sort of regency wigs and stuff. That's very sweet. There's a little wide RC car. There's a version of Pop-Up Pirate, which is like, I almost got it. It's like, it's adorable looking. And it's also just like great because Pop-Up Pirate is one of those things where they always just, you know, there's, I think there's like a Simpsons version where you're probably putting donuts in and then Homer comes out. They also sort of do like a series of, it's kind of like an equivalent to Kinder Surprise where it's like a tin that's shaped like Kuro-chan and you open it and you get a bunch of toys and games and probably a really bad word search, probably like a Christmas cracker joke, I don't know. The first Kuro-chan stuffed toy comes out in 1991 and apparently it outsells the candy itself for a while. and it's at this point when Morinaga literally start minimizing the name Chocoball and they just start putting Kuro-chan on the candy in big letters. It's sort of like, look, buy the product. Like, we know you love the merchandise and you love the characters. So like, yeah, buy this, please. You know, it's what you're here for. And as is the way, as games were especially viewed in this era, if you will, with all the merchandise came some games. and I wanted to run through them. There's only three games, at least as far as I remember. I'm not counting any like smartphone apps or anything. But it's definitely not as extensive as M&M's put themselves out within like, what was that, like a 6-10 year period?
Just over 10 years.
Wow, just over 10 proud years. I mean, some franchises don't make it that long. I don't think Dead Space did, you know, people love that series.
The very similar vibe as well to M&M's Dead Space.
Very similar indeed.
Yeah, horror is beyond your comprehension as you're running through horrible, horrible places.
The bit when the door slammed on the yellow M&M's arm and he had to chew it off. Oh, heart-wrenching. Anyway, enough of that sidebar. So the first game in the illustrious Kuro-chan trilogy is Kuro-chan Land, which is a Game Boy and NES game. Now, this is a fun one because sort of like that puzzle game you mentioned earlier, this is one of those cases where they've licensed a game from somebody else and they've like slapped Kuro-chan into it and, you know, quick sprite swap, bada bing, bada boom. Mm-hmm. The original game is actually quite a notable British microcomputer game called Nebulous. Mm-hmm. It has a bunch of other names as well. It's called like Castilian, I think Tower Topple or something like that as well. It gets, you know, ported around to everything. It starts out on the Commodore 64, I believe. And then it, you know, goes to the Amiga, it goes to the Spectrum. It goes to the Acorn Archimedes, which is one of my favorite names for a computer. We will come back to the Acorn Archimedes someday because there's a fun story behind that as well. You know, it's the PC of the scholars. But when they port it over to Japan, Morinaga get involved. They decide to put their own, you know, Kuro-chan character in. It replaces the sort of frog character, who's just sort of a character that the sprite artist and the designer of the game just sort of does as like a placeholder. It's like, yeah, he'll fit in a, you know, 8x8 space or whatever. Like, that's fine. As of sort of a lot of games of this time, and especially it's like British and European games, like Nebulous just sort of starts out as like a tech demo. It's just this guy fiddling about. His name is John Phillips, by the way. He's just fiddling about trying to do like a sort of rotating cylinder effect of different sprites, and he's fiddling about with like parallax and stuff. He tries doing it on the Spectrum at first, which is just like insane to me. Like, oh my god, like trying to do anything on Spectrum is just like, wow. Genuine like saluting to that. He transitions over to the Commodore 64, and then he's like, oh, I've got this really cool looking sort of effect where it's like, you know, you're looking around a tower of a castle or something. And then he's like, okay, well, I've come up with my cool gimmick, my cool like visual trick. Let's build a game around it. And apparently they come up with a bunch of different things. At one point there's going to be a really ambitious sort of like tower defense thing where you have to like go to different sides and people are like firing arrows across each way. One of his friends steps in and is just like, this is way too ambitious. Like, this is not gonna be a good game. Interestingly, somebody, again, it all comes back to Playdate, but I'm like properly in that community. Somebody's doing a really fun, and I forget the name of it. I'll bring it back up, you know, when it releases and when a demo comes out. Somebody's doing a really fun Advance Wars clone where the twist is instead of looking at a flat map, it's like mapped on a cylinder, a bit like the sort of Animal Crossing rolling world. And you know what that means, David? You know what that means? There's a big cylinder that you can move back and forth.
Cranking it up.
You use the crank. Use the crank. You crank back and forth to pan the map back and forth. I think there's going to be some kind of like mechanic where that changes the time of day as well. It's very early days for development. It was great sort of seeing that spirit of just like making a cool visual effect and then just building the game on top of that is like, you know, that's just programmers will do that. And it still persists to this day. But yeah, so Nebulous comes out in like 87 originally. US Gold get on publishing it, so that's where I it gets ported everywhere. It's a very interesting game, but it, as with a lot of games, again, of this time, it's very built around like trial and error. So the whole point is you're this little frog and you start at the, or, you know, the frog like sort of gremlin creature. Obviously, in the Kuro-chan version, you're this slightly weird looking sprite of Kuro-chan. It's functionally identical though. Like nothing else has changed. It's literally just the main sprite has changed. It's kind of incredible. You're climbing up this castle, and it's one of those games. I always used to. I don't know like how common of an experience this is. I used to, with my friend Theo, we used to draw like sort of mazes for each other on pieces of paper, and then we'd like challenge each other to do it. But the difference would be that we'd have these mazes and it would be like, oh look, there's a spike pit, you've got to jump your pencil over it or whatever. But then often we'd just sort of, the other one of us would have a pencil as well, and we'd be like adding like things and like changing the layout and stuff and just like screwing with each other. It kind of reminds me of that, where it's like, you're climbing this tower, but it's like you, sometimes you'll take a wrong turn. It'll be like, oh no, there's a trap door and you fell all the way down and you know, you lost a life. Or there's a slope that you need to like sort of run up to get up properly. Or you need to like elevate this platform to the right height. You need to wait for an enemy to go past, you know. There's all these different things. And a lot of it is, it's sort of in that like Dragon's Lair way as well. You'll only really know what's there once you've like made the mistake, you know. So it's like definitely an interesting one to play today. I did have quite a lot of fun sort of playing with the rewind feature on this, because it's sort of like, you know, there'd be like a cheap death like that where a trap door would open or an enemy would appear basically out of nowhere, and then they'd be like, nope, I reject that, rewind, okay, right, I'm doing that again. It's quite a short game, all things considered. I think you only climb a few towers in the end. The layouts are all different, but they're very like intricate. It's obviously always the same layout every time. You can kind of jump, but it's a very small jump. And you can also like fire projectiles when you're standing still. But like otherwise, it's just, you know, you're walking left to right. You're slowly ascending this, again, really cool looking effect is this. They create the illusion of you like going around the edges of this castle. Sometimes you go through doors and you emerge at the other end. It's like, it also reminds me of there's that one level in Kirby's Adventure, I think it's called Butter Building, where you're running up the side of this tower and has this similar effect. I think it might even be like an outright tribute, because again, this is one of those games that was, and this happens a lot with Western PC games. They come out, they're quite successful here, and then they have this sort of second life in Japan, and you know, they get licensed out and they build on it and stuff. I don't think Castilian had quite the same effect, but there's stuff like Boulder Dash and Lode Runner got sort of like a whole second life in Japan and a whole life of their own. That might be something that's worth investigating for a future segment. But yeah, you know, it thrives on Game Boy in particular. There's an NES version, you know, it looks fine, but Game Boy, it's quite nice because on the emulator I'm using as well, I turned on like sort of screen blur to make it look a bit more, you know, authentic. And the scrolling effect looks even better there. It looks like super smooth. And yeah, it's just, you know, it's a good game to while away a few minutes in, see how far you can get before, you know, you hit something that you can't get past. And then you're like, yeah, no, that was fun. And, you know, it's one of those games where you go back to it every time, you get a bit better, a bit better, a bit better. And then eventually, you know, you clear it. And then the task from there is like, okay, how quickly can I do it? How many points can I get while I'm doing it, you know? But yeah, you know, fairly pleasant game. It's not that complicated, but I don't think it's also trying to be more than that. It's like, you know, it's one of those games, it's literally a game where it's just a title screen, press start, you're in the game immediately, and then, you know, you're climbing this little tower. But yeah, fun game. You know, Kuro-chan is just entirely just a sprite swap. He's a very wonky-looking version of the character. They animate him quite smoothly when he's turning back and forth, which is fun, but you get, like, you know, they didn't really have model sheets. They just had, like, the one or two illustrations that they put on the chocolate packet. So, like, there's slightly cursed-looking, like, front-facing Kuro-chan sprites. The other thing I suppose I should say is that Kuro-chan is like a very flat looking character, like both of his eyes are on the same side of his head. So it's like imagining that in 3D is like quite an experience.
It's like Alfred Chicken.
Yes, very much like Alfred Chicken. It's what we're all thinking. Um, But yeah, so that comes out in 1990 as well, or 1991, that version of Castilian. Then they don't do much of him afterwards. But interestingly, after this quite early Game Boy game, the next Kuro-chan game is towards the end of the Game Boy's life, in 1998. So 1998, I sort of tipped on before, that's when like James Bond 007 came out. There's like a Beavis and Butthead game, there's an Abe's Odyssey game, there's all these very weird, the first Turok game I think is a black and white Game Boy game. I think like sort of in the wake of Pokemon, or you know, from a Western perspective, in the lead up to Pokemon, sort of interest gets reinvigorated, and with the launch of the Game Boy Pocket as well, and devs are paying attention to Game Boy in a way they haven't in a while. And that leads to the first actually original Kuro-chan game, which is Pocket Kuro-chan. Now this is again a black and white Game Boy exclusive, published by Tomy and developed by Jupiter, who are the sort of basically the developers that have almost exclusively made like Picross games for Nintendo. Like they've been doing it since the original Game Boy. They did like Mario's Picross, and then they did like all the like Japanese exclusive like Super Famicom sequels, and then they did Picross DS, they did all those 3DS games, all those Nintendo Switch like ones. I think they're up to like Picross S9 or something. Really great games. I love Picross. I don't know if you've ever played them, David. It's sort of like a cross between a word search or a crossword and Sudoku.
Yeah, I played the Zelda themed one.
Yes, that was where I got into it. The one that they gave away with my Nintendo, which I will touch upon in a future segment. So stay tuned, listeners, if you want to hear about my Nintendo.
It's not your Nintendo. It's my Nintendo.
But yeah, Jupiter do occasionally take on side projects when they're not just like absolutely cracking out these Picross games. And yeah, they put out this game, Pocket Kuro-chan. And at first you look at that and you're thinking, oh, 1998, Game Boy. Okay, so they're trying to do a sort of Tamagotchi thing. Like it's going to be a little Kuro-chan virtual pet. And it's kind of that, but it's also this weird kind of like indirect point and click adventure game. I don't know if you've ever played or heard about like Pac-Man 2, The New Adventures on Super NES. No.
No.
So Pac-Man 2 is fascinating because, you know, it's the only game in the series that's called Pac-Man 2. There's plenty of Pac-Man sequels, spin-offs, Ms. Pac-Man, Junior Pac-Man, Baby Pac-Man, Professor Pac-Man, Pac-Land, Pac-and-Pal. I can literally just write all these rages. I don't know why this occupies a space in my brain, but it does. But the first game that was called Pac-Man 2 was this game on the SNES, and I think it was on the Mega Drive as well. And it's this weird point and click where you don't have direct control over Pac-Man. You're sort of supposed to help him like do his day-to-day tasks, but the only tool you have, at least at the start, is like a slingshot that you shoot little rocks at. And you're literally supposed to sort of like shoot the rocks at Pac-Man to sort of nudge him around, get him to kind of like go in the right direction. He's a very clumsy character as well. He's very Mr. Bean-like. He'll often like fall over or like ignore you, or you just sort of have to like goad him into doing what you need him to do. You know, you'll I'm trying to remember any of the specific puzzles because it's been a while since I played it, and it's a very odd game. It's more like a programming game than a point and click, if you get what I mean. Like Pac-Man's almost like an AI that you've got to like train. You've got to like I think you have to get like a bucket to fall on his head at one point, and then that like helps you like guide him along. Very strange game. I'd kind of recommend it just as this weird curio, because it's this bizarre interpretation of like a point and click adventure game. And it's also just such a weird game to call Pac-Man 2, because the gameplay is nothing like any of the Pac-Man games. Like the ghosts show up, but you know, there's no mazes. I think like power pellets show up like four times. It's episodic as well. It has like four episodes, which again, just crazy for its time for point and click. But Pocket Kuro-chan just reminds me quite a bit of that, because it's this game where you're thankfully not firing things at Kuro-chan, which is nice. I don't really want to be shooting pellets at like a little bird. But you're clicking about and stuff, and you're kind of nudging and suggesting things for him to do. Now, obviously, this is a game that's entirely in Japanese, and it's very reliant on Japanese knowledge. It is it's quite common for games of this time, because if people aren't aware, the main writing systems in Japanese are like kanji, which are like the sort of pictorial looking ones. The more like complex looking ones, the ones that people associate with like Chinese as well. And then there's hiragana and katakana, which are essentially like the different vowel sounds and syllables, that's what I'm searching for, of words. And, you know, you can spell out a word with katakana or hiragana, but, you know, more often than not, people use the kanji because it's sort of like, it's more of a pictorial reference. And once you sort of get an idea of like what they're meant to represent, you're like, oh, okay, it's like the kanji for mountain kind of looks like a mountain. The kanji for the sun, you know, kind of looks like a very square looking sun. It gets quite abstract, but, you know, you get the hang of it.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of early 8-bit games had trouble with this because kanji is like, again, quite pictorial. A lot of it's based around quite distinct strokes, and fitting that into text boxes on a low resolution screen can be difficult. So a lot of early Japanese games, if they don't just outright use English script, you know, whether that's writing the Japanese words out with Latin characters or just straight up being written in English, they tend to sort of write everything out in katakana or hiragana more often, which is just sort of like, it's kind of like if you spelled things out letter by letter, but there were no spaces. So it can be a little tricky to get the hang of, because you kind of have to sort of know what words they're hinting at. There's a lot of homonyms and, you know, similar sounding words in Japanese as well. So when you don't have kanji to help, that can be tricky. Anyway, this is a long way of saying that it's all written out in hiragana, so it's intended to be child friendly, but also friendly to the low res screen. My very, 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 very intermediate level Japanese, like, only kind of got me so far. I did find someone had done a very good sort of let's play of it on stream. It's a user called Pixelated Crown. I've watched some of their other stuff before. It's really fun stuff. They have like an interpreter on call who's like sort of translating stuff as they go. But basically the whole game is about you kind of socialize. It's part point and click, part social simulator. You kind of socialize with Kuro-chan. You like talk to him. And it's a very rudimentary. It's like it's as much of a conversation simulator as like The Sims is. It's like you literally select him and then just select Tomodachi, which is the phrase for friend. And then he just goes like, oh, Tomodachi back. And then it's like, great, you're friends now, which is great. But, you know, you have to like persevere with it. You have to like select things over and over. He might get a little distracted. He might just be sort of whistling. He might not want to do that right now. So you have to sort of like, it's a bit of give and take with him, which can be a little frustrating, especially if you don't quite understand what's going on. But yeah, it's a really like interesting game because it shows how far the Game Boy's come since this quite early like Commodore 64 conversion, to where they're doing this quite complex social sim crossed with a point and click adventure. And then like, yeah, little bits here and there of just like, it's a really unique game, basically. And it's, I don't know why they picked Kuro-chan for it. I don't know if it was just sort of something where they were like, we want to make the character more endearing, so we're putting him in this social environment. But yeah, it's an interesting game. It's a tough one to play if you don't know Japanese, but I do recommend watching the Pixelated Crown playthrough. I'm going to put a link to it in the description. You know, have a fun time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the third and final Kuro-chan, perhaps the biggest event of all, and I want to roll out the red carpet, I want to toot the horn, because incredibly, this is actually quite a good game, and it's completely original, completely just built from the ground up with Kuro-chan in mind. So the next Kuro-chan game, and sort of the final one on consoles, kind of ties into something else quite big that happens with Kuro-chan, which is that amazingly he gets his own anime series.
Kuro-chan!
Yeah, and it's a long-running one as well, fairly long-running at least. It goes from 1999 to 2001 on TV Tokyo. This is something I completely didn't know before I started researching this. I was like, what? It's kind of like if, like, the best thing I can think is, like, Tony the Tiger or, like, Professor Weetos just got, like, a, like, animated series. It's not really about, like, the product either. It's, like, the first episode starts out, and you can find it on the Internet Archive. I'm going to put a link in the description. There's no subtitles or anything, but it's for kids. You can follow along fairly well. They repeat words a lot as well, so it was actually quite good for my learning. I was like, oh, right, no, duh, that's what that word means. They're recontextualizing it. It starts out with this, like, explorer that discovers Kuro-chan and, like, an ancient temple. He, like, discovers this little egg that hatches. And then it's sort of implied that they, like, sail the world and explore together for many years. And then, oh no, the ship gets overturned. He gets lost at sea. And then Kuro-chan's kind of going on this grand adventure to try and find the explorer, like, sort of his father, I guess. And he meets other characters along the way. You know, it's one of those sort of ensemble series from what I could see.
Mm-hmm.
Watch that first episode. You know, it's fine. There's a lot of repetition. There's a lot of yelling. The animation's very pleasant because it's still cell animation. So it's just, you know, it's warm, it's fuzzy, and it's fun. I didn't find which studio produced it. I don't think they're about anymore, but yeah, just a very pleasant and strange anime series that got its own sort of reel of merchandise that's very difficult to find these days. But also in 1999 there was a big game, and this time it's on the PlayStation, and it's called Kuro-chan no Pyurikura Daisesuken, which roughly translates to Kuro-chan's Great Picture Booth Adventure. Now, that's very interesting, because obviously you just sort of see it in the script. You're like, what is Pyurikura? That's sort of like the, you know, the sort of like instant passport photos you get in like malls and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And like the way I think we kind of view it as a society, especially these days, is it's very functional. It's like maybe there'll be like a couple wacky filters where it's like you can make yourself, you could be like, oh, Liverpool FC, and it's like a head cut out, you put your head in, you know. I don't know if you ever saw that, like there's that Twitter post some ages ago where someone's nan went to get passport photos and they accidentally turned that on and they're just looking like really confused, and it's like, oh, go on, you Reds, fantastic. But in Japan, especially at sort of, you know, the end of the 20th century, it was quite popular as sort of like, you know, a social experience you'd get. I mean, I think it was still about over here, but I don't think it was ever as popular as it was in Japan, where, you know, it would be like, you know, you go in with your friends, with your teen friends, and you'll get these fun pictures, and it's, you know, the same sort of thing as like, I suppose it's kind of comparable to like sticking your head through the seaside amusements and being like, oh, look, you're the donkey, you're the cowboy, haha, woo. Except, you know, with a lot more glitz and glamour and sparkly filters over everything. The interesting thing I found was that often these booths would outright, like, not only was their demographic like teen girls, but often like you just wouldn't allow, like there'd be signs up that'd be like, don't go in here if you're not a teen girl, which is like, ooh, okay, interesting. I suppose it's like they were entirely built around that. Maybe there were, you know, privacy concerns, whatever. But yeah, they build a game around this for some reason, and I don't know why, because it's published by Tomy as well. The developer were quite tricky to find. Again, I don't think they really did much else. I'm trying to see if I did put it in my notes at the end. I did not. Anyway, very small developer. I think they were called like, no, I don't have them.
But I found the developer that made it though.
So. Oh, okay. It was David Incorporated. Maybe it was Mars getting one in under the radar. they were, somebody there was furious at having to make these M&M's games and they defected. And that's where the quality fell through the floor. As if it was above the floor to begin with. But yeah, this is a really interesting game because it's a very colorful 2D platformer on the PS1. And there's a sort of, I don't know how much of it is rooted in reality because things kind of vary, but apparently there was a sort of mandate, especially in the American branch of Sony, that like 2D games were like out. It was like, if you pitched a 2D game to them, it would be very hard to get funding on. They really wanted to push polygons. You know, early in the system's life, you've got stuff like Rayman, and then like Castlevania Symphony of the Night in like 97. But like, there's some quite infamous reviews of like Symphony of the Night from the time where people are like, "Ugh, no, pixel graphics, boop. This is the Super Nintendo. Like, what is this?" Ugh. So it's quite refreshing to see a game. Because, you know, the PS1's a bit more powerful than the SNES, I'd say, and it's at a higher resolution, so it's, like, much more detailed pixel art can come from it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's got this very endearing sort of crayon style, this game. The closest thing I can compare it to stylistically and, like, gameplay-wise is, like, Yoshi's Story, where you're sort of, like, it's not a challenging game by any stretch. The levels are quite big and open, and it's just sort of about like exploring it and finding, you know, different collectibles and secrets. The main sort of MacGuffin in the game is the titular Purikura booths. So if you find one of those in the level, you go up to them, Kuro-chan sticks his head through, and then like a sort of roulette wheel happens, and you like pick the frame and you pick the pose, and then you line up Kuro-chan inside the pose, and then you just take a picture, and then, you know, that's the collectible. It doesn't affect anything. There's no score or anything. You just sort of do it for fun, you know. If you want to see him pull a goofy face while he's in a wedding dress, then go for it. Occasionally there's like little mini games where like you've got to get him in like a basketball hoop, like different basketballs are getting fired, and then sometimes Kuro-chan himself goes flying up, and you get the most points if you land him in the basket. But yeah, it's like a very chill game. Kuro-chan feels quite heavy is the only thing. Like, he has the flutter jump like Yoshi does, but it doesn't really get him very far. He can dash a little bit, but like, it, you know, it's not super fast or anything. It's just this very chill game where you're kind of just going around stomping on the enemies. It's got this really fun bombastic soundtrack. I only played a few levels in the end because it was a little maybe too slow, a little too pedestrian, but it's the kind of thing where it's like, you know, it's probably aimed at kids, and it's at least very technically competent. The visuals aren't outright offensive, as again, it sounded like some of the M&M's games got. I don't recall any bits where I was able to look through the levels, which would be impressive for a 2D game, but I mean, I'm sure there's some 2D dreck on the PlayStation that found a way. But yeah, it's like, it's a very cutesy little game, and if I had to recommend any of these games, it would definitely be that one. If you, you know, find a way to load up a PS1 file on your PS1 console of choice from Sony Entertainment Limited, you know, go for it. Knock yourself out. It's a fun little time. But yeah, like, I thought it was sort of interesting to explore this sort of weird full circle moment where Nintendo made this character that was parodying this other character who was just like sort of a chocolate mascot, but this mascot also was so popular that he had his own series of games, and then maybe Puro is like directly parodying that, and all that kind of leads me to just sort of like, are either of them gonna properly acknowledge each other? Like, is Kuro-chan gonna have another, because, you know, the last game was in 1999, the first WarioWare's 2003. They've done a couple like sort of apps and stuff with Kuro-chan, but they haven't done any sort of games since, as far as I could see. So, you know, will they ever do another Kuro-chan game? Will Kuro-chan and Puro have a crossover? Will they maybe do Puro-themed chocolates? Or is it like, if either of them steps on each other's territory in that way, is that when the gavel comes down and the lawsuits come out, you know? I will sort of say, as sort of an addendum and a sort of wrap-up of this, was that I, as you can probably tell, I found myself quite enraptured by this character. I fell under his spell. And I was looking around on Mercari and like Yahoo auctions and stuff, and trying to see if I could find some fun merchandise to pick up, and I found a little LCD style Game and Watch game. Heartbreakingly, it didn't come with a battery, so I haven't had a chance to try it yet, but I do want to give it a go because Puro has such a Game and Watch style design that I thought it would be fun to play an actual like LCD game with the character that inspired it. While I was doing that, however, I did pick up a few other things, and I'll put some images of them in the description or something. I picked up a polyethylene sort of print shirt that has Kuro-chan all over it, which I think was like something you got in a UFO catcher or something. I got a very large 30-centimeter plush, and I also got a small little like bag that you... It came as like a free gift with like a... a women's lifestyle magazine. You know, as you do. And it's just a little bag that you can put your lipstick or your lip balm in or whatever and hang it off the side of your bag. So I've got all these Kurochan plushies. I got these figures and stuff. I've never imported stuff from Japan before, and I didn't realize that it was going to cost me about £50 to get all this stuff. So, share the podcast around. Your friends know. We'll, you know, I'm rattling my can. Look, I'm fine financially, to be totally clear. But it was a big shock to, you know, pick up some of this stuff. Quite a bargain price. You know, I got the little plush was like £2. The Game & Watch was like a fiver. But then when I consolidated it all, it was like, here's the custom fees, and it's £50 altogether. And I was like, oh, God. So... I suppose the cautionary tale is to beware the witch's spell as far as the marketable chocolate mascots go, because they just want your money at the end of the day. They doesn't matter whether the games are good, doesn't matter whether the games are bad, doesn't matter whether they have charm or whether they're the yellow M&M. They will rinse you for all it's worth. So stay savvy, gamers, and don't let these corporations... steal your money, because they will take it in a second.
And they'll crunch you away like yesterday's chocolate, you know?
They very much will. Yesterday's chocolate is as good as today's chocolate to them. They're sickos. Psychos in that way. Odd. Anyway, before the podcast completely gets away from us, I suppose this is a good point to bow out, do our outros. David, what have you been up to lately? Where can people find you? And if you have anything to plug, please feel free to do so, because we don't have any advertising.
I'm advertising destroying every stock of M&M you can find.
Okay.
It's an easy task. It might...
sort of like when people were encouraging each other to mess up Mr. Beast's feastable shelves or whatever. Yeah. Or he was asking people to fix them for him, wasn't he?
Who knows?
No, it's a... That was the discourse of the day.
Mr. Beaks is an anagram of M&M eat, so it's not, but, you know, it could be.
It's got one of the M's.
Yeah, it's, what, you just need one M, you know? M&M would stand for, I don't know,
I don't think it stands for anything.
It doesn't.
I think it's one of the great mysteries.
It doesn't stand for anything, because it wouldn't get back to me, so therefore it has no honor. So, yeah, I don't know, at F-E-W-P-A-T, yeah, I think, I don't know if there's a project involving me that's happening. I don't know if it'll be out by this point, but YouTube for some interesting original stuff coming up. You know, there's something.
We might, the Friendly Mush YouTube channel might have either launched by this point or be in the works. We're going to put up, you know, some clips of old episodes. We're going to do some cross promo of some of the other series. See where it takes us, because, you know, YouTube's a totally different platform, and it's a fun one to explore. I think Potter Who Cast, at the time this episode comes out, will have just wrapped up its fifth series.
It probably has. I don't know, we're so far ahead of schedule. Sarah Jane Adventure series 4, no thank you. Otherwise, yeah,
I'm Sammy_Crow. You can find me on Twitter and Blue Sky and other sites of that caliber. Maybe I'll update my backlog. We always update the At Gamer Era podcast backlog of the games we've talked about.
Maybe 2 or 3 days late each time, because it's
It's I'm rubbing my fingers. The finger thing means the taxes. But yeah, you can also find Gamer Era Podcast at Gamer Era Podcast on Twitter and probably Blue Sky as well. And all the other shows are at friendlymush.com, which is the podcast network we're a part of. But yeah, thank you for listening to this episode of Gamer Era. Choco away!
Smarties made by the Mars Corporation as well.
Nestle.
Nestle.
No.
Do you want a sponsorship from Nestle?
No, we're not going to near Nestle. No, thank you. No, thank you. Tony's Chocolonely. I don't like your chocolate, but I've always found your name to be very funny. And Hershey's, you taste like vomit. I'm sorry. We're not going anywhere near you. But yeah, M&M's. Delicious treat? I don't think so.
Wow.